You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Dutch voters go to the polls. How many of them will consummate their country's flirtation with the race baiting of Geert Wilders? My guests Michael Clark and Jacob Parakilis will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including an uptick in defence spending by NATO members. But are they more worried at this point by Russia or the United States? We'll look at the secret life of Rex Tillerson, plus the return of this thing.
It just seems to me that this is something that the American people deserve to see, and I have no reason to believe that he's ever going to release his tax returns because there's something he's hiding. We'll keep guessing at what it might be that he's hiding.
The thing in question being Trump's taxes, not Hillary Clinton, but a purported Trump tax bombshell proves to be something of a dud. What do we still need to know? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Clark, Specialist in Defence Studies and former Director General of the Royal United Services Institute, and Jacob Parakilis, Assistant Head of the US and the Americas Programme at Chatham House. Welcome both. We will start in the Netherlands, where any Dutch listeners have a couple more hours to get themselves to a polling booth. While Dutch elections do not usually transfix the continent, this is not a usual election. There will be many who feel that if a hefty vote for Geert Wilders' xenophobic Freedom Party confirms that even the proverbially sensible and liberal Dutch have gone full Yahoo, then Europe may shortly have bigger problems than the UK leaving it. Jacob, first of all, the fact that Wilders, even if he wins, in inverted commas, i.e. wins the most seats, has virtually no hope of forming a government, does that make him, in fact, even more dangerous?
I don't think it necessarily makes him more dangerous. I think it certainly makes him more influential. I mean, the way that people outside the Netherlands seem to be looking at this is of a leading indicator of the French and German elections. And that may be a little bit unfair to the Dutch, but I think there is, over the last year and a half, this phenomenon where we're linking a bunch of different expressions of nationalism in countries whose elections don't necessarily have any correlation with each other to try to determine whether this is all part of some upsurge of populism or nationalism or far-rightism, whatever you want to call it, or whether this is a bunch of sort of superficially similar characters all happening to come to the fore at once.
Michael, Dutch Prime Minister for the moment, Mark Rutte, has urged voters today to repudiate what he described as the wrong kind of populism. Is there a right kind?
Well, what he means is sort of citizenship populism, the sort of populism that wants to build communities rather than split them. And, I mean, Prime Minister Rutte has made a big play in these television debates, saying that, you know, this is the chance for the Netherlands to turn back the tide of populism in Europe. As Jacob was saying, I mean, it is a sort of touchstone to other elections, and it shouldn't be, but it is. And so Rutte is saying, vote Wilders down, vote the Freedom Party down to show that populism, this rather unpleasant populism, is not on the rise. There isn't momentum behind it. And however well Wilders does when the polls close in a couple of hours' time, people will not work with him. So it's inconceivable that he could form a government. But he will be an influential figure, unless he gets wiped out, which he won't. Then he will be an influential figure in the future of certainly Netherlands politics.
Jacob, this is where I've always wanted to do this. This is where I get to do that election night thing of getting a pundit to talk about stuff when we've got absolutely no idea what's going on. So this is me being a proper election night anchor here. Jacob, there's reports of high turnout. What does that tell us?
Absolutely nothing.
It means the weather's been good.
It means the weather's been good. No, I mean the sort of scattered anecdotal reports you get, the early exit polls, and I'm relying very much on my sort of U.S. politics background here, but, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. happen fundamentally until the actual results come in. And there are all kinds of leading indicators that you can look at as a way of trying to get an indication, but basically it's a signal of, you know, general human impatience that we look for the weather and we look for exit polls and we look for, because we can't wait that 4 or 5 or 6 more hours to actually see the results. But, you know, these things actually don't historically have a very good track record of predicting elections. And when they do, it's because the election was fundamentally predictable to begin with.
but it will be a coalition, almost certainly. I mean, we're talking about Dutch politics being Dutch politics. So many parties, so many splits in the sort of basic left, right, center, liberal spectrum that there will be a coalition. So the issue is, who will lead the coalition? What will be the weight of the coalition? And does the Wilders effect, the Freedom Party effect, does that lean on the coalition a bit? Or does it oppose the coalition, whatever it might be? Does it go into sort of guerrilla warfare in political terms? Or does it demand some sort of seat at the table, even implicitly? That'll be the question for tomorrow or Friday, when we really see what the results look like.
Well, to follow that up, Wilders has said that whatever the result, he's managing expectations there already, the genie will not go back in the bottle, and this patriotic revolution will take place. Now, Jacob was talking about the fact that this is being looked at more than usually as an indicator of what we might expect from France, from Germany, but as we consider the rise of this nativist blood and soil populism across Europe as a whole, is it your sense that some sort of traumatic or at least dramatic catharsis is inevitable? Or is this something that might kind of fizzle?
I don't think it's at all inevitable, but it's entirely plausible. Things that we didn't think were possible a year ago now seem plausible. So it is plausible that Marine Le Pen may actually emerge as the next French president. Now, that would have seemed inconceivable a year ago. She will do well, and she'll get through the first ballot in the French elections. But the view is, as with Wilders, that everybody unites against the extremists when it comes to the second ballot.
Well, as they did when her old man made the second round and France united behind the slogan.
Exactly. And the view was that
vote for the crook, not the fascist.
Exactly the same happened to Marine Le Pen. But see what else has happened in the sense that other candidates are falling out, in the sense that you know, French politics is now, for reasons that are not to do with Marine Le Pen, are actually up in the air, so that the unthinkable may happen because the timetables of history are all moving very quickly and they're beginning to clash together. And so what happens in the Netherlands is, you know, we say it's only the Netherlands. It's this settled, remarkably liberal, democratic country. But it is a sort of a bellwether of what may happen elsewhere. And there is a momentum for the crude populists in Europe, undoubtedly, as there is in the United States. But it's not inevitable, because these things are, it's a matter of time and chance.
Just a final thought on this one from you, Jacob. If, as is widely predicted, Wilders does win the most seats but still can't govern, what is his next move?
I think his next move, in some ways, I think that's kind of an ideal circumstance for him, because as we've seen from the sort of pre-Article 50 negotiations, as we've seen with Trump's attempts to get a handle on the federal government, being an outside agitator is a lot easier and a lot, in a way, more satisfying than actually
It's much more fun than making sure the bins get collected, water comes out of the taps, isn't
it?
Well,
also, people can't blame you. If you're sitting on the largest block of votes in Parliament but you can't actually do anything with them, then you can throw stones in from outside, you can exercise power, but no one's actually going to look to you to do the job of governing. You can make your points without being held responsible for anything that goes wrong. So in some ways, I think, you know, it might be a silver lining for Wilders if he actually doesn't end up in power.
Okay, well, let's stay with Europe while we move along, because Europe's possible last standing grown-up, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, is due to meet US President Donald Trump later this week, or when it stops snowing, whichever comes first. Among likely topics of a scarcely imaginable conversation is NATO defence spending. Almost all NATO members, Germany included, still fall short of the 2% of GDP guideline on defence spending. However, that has recently been inching generally upwards, though whether this is principally a response to Trump or to Vladimir Putin is debatable. Michael, first of all, this 2% guideline, this idea that a responsible dues-paying NATO member should spend 2% of its GDP on defence, does it do more harm than good? Is it just a stick that the US and the UK can use to beat almost everybody else with?
It is, because it's politically important. In other words, 2% is something that everyone can understand. You must spend 2% of your GDP on defence, whatever your GDP happens to be. Of course, 2% is quite a low figure. Even at the end of the Cold War, Britain is now spending just dead on 2%. At the end of the Cold War, we're spending 4.5%. Most of the countries are spending 3%. 3.5%, and so on. So 2% is a very arbitrary figure, but it has political importance because it's understandable. Congress understands it. The public can understand it. So it becomes a sort of a measure. It's not a measure of combat effectiveness. And within that 2% commitment, the commitment that the Allies made at the Wales summit 4 or 5 years ago now, that commitment also included a commitment both to move towards 2% of GDP across the board, and they're nowhere near it yet, but also to make sure that at least 20% of their defence spending went on equipment. Because in many countries, most of the money goes on paying pensions for too many soldiers and too many officers. And so the issue is that a lot of European defence budgets are very badly structured. And so countries have got big forces on paper, but they can't transport them anywhere. They've got no ammunition. They've got no backup. They can't plug into the ISTAR systems, the electronic surveillance systems that are all part of the modern battlefield. And so we've got on paper a series of forces in NATO, many of which are quite hollow. You know, they've got the outside bit, but there's nothing behind them. Now, that's not the case everywhere, but NATO defence is not in good shape. And President Trump is only echoing what previous presidents have said, in that you guys have got to make an effort. You've got to come to at least 2%. That's the minimum you've got to make. The difference with President Trump is that everyone's frightened of him. He has he has working for him fear and unpredictability. And the sense is that whereas other presidents have said it, and if the Europeans didn't do it, they'd just carp on and carp on. If Trump says it and they don't do it, he's quite capable of just walking away, of doing something drastic, of changing the geopolitical wheel on the basis of what he said. So in a sense, his demand carries more weight than many American demands I've seen for quite some time.
Jacob, we've also seen this week a physical manifestation of what NATO's supposed to do, i.e. keep Europe safe from Russia, I guess. We've seen the deployment of the 5th Battalion of the British Army's the Rifles Regiment to Estonia as part of a wider deployment to the Baltic states. Is this, though, basically symbolic? Does it really sort of make it any more or less likely that Russia would attempt something precipitous in Estonia or Latvia?
The question of do 800 soldiers, British, American, any variety, actually deter Russia in terms of a military presence? No. I mean, Russia can call snap exercises with 40,000 troops in close proximity to the Baltic states. There's no sort of balance there in terms of the absolute numbers. What it is a trigger. You don't put forces there as an attempt to match Russia on a soldier-for-soldier, tank-for-tanker, artillery-tube-for-artillery-tube basis. You do it because it's a sign of commitment, and the idea being that, you know, were there to be some kind of crisis or scrap, and were NATO soldiers not belonging to the Baltic states to be imperiled, that would make the triggering of Article 5 inevitable rather than sort of politically questionable. So it's not a question of, you know, obviously you need to put forces with sufficient logistics and readiness to actually undertake missions if necessary, but it's not a question of NATO's capability to, you know, fight Russia sort of tomorrow if necessary. It's more a statement of intent.
The problem, as Jacob said, with the Article 5 triggering is it regarded as entirely automatic. It should be, according to the treaty. It should be, according to what NATO says in all of its statements. But the fear in NATO is not that Russian tanks would rumble across the border in Estonia or Lithuania, but that there would be the little green men, the subversion, as we saw in the Donbass region in Ukraine, and that parts of, let's say, eastern Lithuania, which has already been sort of softened up in a psychological battle, parts of eastern Lithuania suddenly become no-go areas for even the Vilnius government, which is in eastern Lithuania. But parts of the Baltics suddenly look as if they're trying to break away on the base of Russian-speaking minorities or other groups. And that effectively, one of the Baltic states would find itself eaten away at, and NATO would not have reacted. And the point is not that the Russians want that territory, but that they'd have knocked a hole in the indivisibility of NATO. They would have actually challenged Article 5. NATO would not have responded with Article 5, which is the automatic attack on one is attack on all. And if that happened, that NATO's credibility would be fatally weakened. And what the Russians would then be interested in is that in the south, in Bulgaria and Romania and Slovakia, those countries would start to say, well, actually, NATO is not probably going to defend us. NATO's credibility is low. And so they will start to behave the way Finland behaved during the Cold War. They would not want to upset the Russians. They wouldn't swap sides. They can't do that. But they would suddenly become rather compliant with what Moscow's wishes were. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but one of the scenarios NATO worries about is that it will be challenged on Article 5 in ways that it does not respond to. Its credibility, therefore, suffers, and it begins to lose a lot of its eastern and southeastern coherence as an alliance.
Jacob, does, though, the, and this is not me sort of taking the Kremlin line that they are being steadily encircled theory seriously, but does, is it arguable that the presence of NATO troops in such numbers in the Baltic states actually makes a kind of, you know, asymmetrical shenanigans of the sort that Michael is describing more likely? There has been a warning sent out to the soldiers deploying about staged pub brawls or honey traps, and it reminded me, I was in Ukraine last year for Monocle magazine doing a story on the Canadian troops who are there training the Ukrainian military. And in Lviv and Kamenets Podilsky, where they were staying, all those soldiers were under similar orders. Don't go to bars, don't engage with crowds, don't go out by yourself, etc., etc., etc. How great a risk is the very fact of a NATO presence giving Russians leverage to cause trouble?
It's a tightrope that NATO nations have to walk in terms of what presence they put there, because obviously they can't just have a sort of political commitment not backed up. There has to be visible, meaningful sort of presence of military forces. Otherwise, NATO isn't meaningful as a military alliance. But by the same token, it's the classic security dilemma of international relations. You want to signal commitment. You want to signal deterrence. You want to demonstrate to your allies that you'll stand with them. You don't want to provoke in your enemy or your adversary the view that you are moving against them. And part of the issue there is signaling, and signaling to the Russians that this is a defensive movement, not an offensive one. NATO hasn't always been capable of signaling intentions clearly to Russia. Russia, for that matter, hasn't always cared to signal clearly to NATO. And right now, especially with the U.S. in a state of political turmoil with, I think it's fair to say, different instincts in the White House, in the NSC, in the DOD, and in the State Department, not to mention Congress, the ability of the NATO's biggest power, its military backbone, to actually say clearly to the Russians with words and actions all as one, this is a defensive action, this is the absolute red line that you cannot cross. NATO's entire commitment, its entire ability to sort of signal that deterrent strength is limited.
And just as a practical issue, what the troops will be being told, the British troops who are going, is, this is not just a friendly deployment to an ally where you can essentially just do your 9-to-5 jobs and then go and meet the locals and behave as normal. This is an operational deployment.
This is not Cyprus, basically.
Exactly. So if you're going to go to a bar, you never go on your own. You report when you're going. You say when you're going to come back. If you're going to go X and Y, you tell us the route you're going to take. Just, this is exactly what they did in Bosnia when the fighting stopped. Some of us were there at the time, and the procedures that the military follow to make sure that everyone stays within a sort of an envelope of predictability are quite impressive. And I'm sure that's what they'll do in the Baltics. They'll say, "Look, guys, this is not an easy posting. There will be issues, so we're going to treat it as an operational posting, and these are the procedures you will follow." And believe me, they will.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Michael Clark, and Jacob Parakilis. Coming up next, Donald Trump's taxes and Rex Tillerson's imaginary alter ego.
The Big Interview, the show that brings you the fascinating life stories of some of the most influential people in the world of art and culture, business and politics, continues this week with Susan Goldberg.
There is nothing more thrilling than creating an atmosphere where people can tell the very, very best stories that make a difference in communities.
National Geographic's editor-in-chief sits down with Monocle's Thomas Lewis in Washington, D.C. to discuss some implications of the U.S.'s new government, the role of women in media, what makes a good cover, and how to steer a legacy brand through changing times.
We are all about the facts, and we will follow where the science takes us and where the reporting takes us, and that's what makes us strong, that's what makes us distinctive, and that's got to be our position in the market.
The Big Interview with Susan Goldberg premieres this Sunday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Michael Clark and Jacob Parakilis. Now, the tax returns of US President Donald Trump are presently the most sought-after prize in journalism. His refusal to release them as a candidate, in accordance with long-standing convention, inevitably served to convince everybody that they must secrete something dreadful, though it's difficult to imagine what could be much worse than what we already know. Last night, MSNBC broadcast a leaked copy of Trump's 2005 1985 return, which, to the palpable disappointment of a watching world, revealed that, in that year, Trump paid $38 million in tax on $150 million in income, i.e. roughly fair enough. Jacob, did this tell us anything really all that interesting?
Not really. It told us that Trump's income at a time when he was beginning to transition from a sort of property developer to more of a branding and reality TV show business basis was fairly high. It told us that he took care of he used the alternative minimum tax, which is a means for the IRS to extract a reasonable tax base from wealthy citizens whose incomes are primarily from investments.
That's a scheme he's trying to cancel,
and
by the
and
way.
That's
a Ronald Reagan scheme that he wants to cancel.
If
that hadn't been in place, he would have paid $3 million taxes,
right?
Isn't it? $4 million.
Yeah. This is the one interesting thing about this is that his tax plan would massively benefit himself. But we already knew that, because any reasonable estimate of Trump's income, whether sort of cynical or taking him at his word, had him making large amounts of money from investment income.
In fairness, as well, any Republican's president's tax plan would massively benefit Donald Trump,
not including Donald Trump's tax plan from 1999, where he proposed a massive confiscatory tax regime on very wealthy citizens to pay for entitlement reform, which is very interesting, but it's almost like
he just makes it up as he goes, isn't
it? It's almost like he has no loyalty to his previous statements.
Michael, we did not learn much, though, about the sources of income. Is that more important?
That, in a way, that's interesting, because we know, he declared $150 million. We know that in that there's $100 million write-down, so it'd be interesting to know in a bit more detail what that write-down consisted of. And what people are interested in is how much of his money is made, say, in Russia and through Russian-connected organizations, and how much of it is written down regularly and in what, against what. The other issue is this is a 2005 tax return. Everybody would love to see his 2010, 2012 tax returns. The general buzz today on this around Westminster, for instance, is that because he was a business tycoon, because he was then a reality TV star, he was putting material about himself out there very vigorously until he decided to become a political candidate. And so there's a massive stuff out there. And the fact that there's a 2005 tax return out there indicates that there'll be lots of others. And the general view is there's a massive material about Mr. Trump, which will just keep bubbling to the surface because everyone's got a little bit. When a whole picture will be put together, or if it'll be put together, we don't know. But this is the beginning of a real trend. I mean, lots and lots of bits of paper are now going to surface.
The 2005 is really interesting, though, because it is also the year that a reporter named Timothy O'Brien wrote a book about Trump, which indicated that he was told by multiple sources with close information about Trump's net worth that it was actually between $150 and $250 million, which is an order of magnitude smaller than he's claimed to be. Trump sued O'Brien. O'Brien got access to Trump's taxes in discovery, wasn't allowed to comment on them publicly, but O'Brien won the case and has said subsequently, people should see Trump's taxes. Yeah. He can't say any more than that.
But. Well, I mean, on the campaign trail, early on the campaign trail, Trump always said, I'm such a successful businessman. I'm worth $10 billion. Mm-hmm. And Fortune magazine said they could never find more than four at most, maybe somewhere between $3 and $4 billion, which is still quite a lot. But he insisted he was worth $10 billion, but nobody could make that stack up.
Well, his way of making that stack up is suggesting that his brand is worth something like $5 billion. But his brand is basically his own estimation of his brand's value, which I don't know that would be accepted practice at any chartered accountancy firm.
Jacob, what do we make of Trump's response to this? Inevitably, it's the all-cap explanation of fake news, though the White House have nonetheless confirmed the top-line figures. We're starting to see a pattern here, though, aren't we? His own White House having to admit that they've got really no idea what the president is talking about. We've also seen the House Intelligence Chair, Devin Nunes, hitherto a Trump ally, basically giving him up on the phone-tapping claim, saying we cannot stand this up at all.
Well, I think those are two very separate things. I mean, the fake news claim is basically just, it's Trump's version of a period at the end of the sentence. It's worked into his statements. It's worked into any declamation of anything he doesn't like. The question of, you know, whether this return hurts him, honestly, this leak is probably more beneficial to him. I mean, as I said, the only thing it tells us is that he'd benefit from his own tax plan, and we knew that already. It also puts paid to some of the rumors that he didn't pay any tax tax at all in the 2000s. We've seen his 1995 tax returns during the campaign, and that suggested that maybe he wouldn't have had to pay tax for 18 years. This suggests that 10 years after that, he was once again paying federal income tax. So it sort of, it cuts the legs slightly out from some of those questions that came up. And it doesn't by itself, I mean, this is two pages. This is the executive summary of Trump's 2005 tax return. So it doesn't really tell us anything aside from he's wealthy and he paid taxes, which frankly, I don't think hurts him politically.
Well, he has since resumed tweeting abuse at Snoop Dogg. So we've returned to business as usual. And finally tonight, to the curious case of former ExxonMobil chief Rex Tillerson, who since being appointed U.S. Secretary of State has been seen in public slightly less frequently than D.B. Cooper. We have, however, this week gleaned an entrancing insight into his personal life with the revelation that for many years, Tillerson maintained an online alias for the purposes of discussing climate change. Meet Wayne Tracker. Michael, how do we rate Wayne Tracker as a pseudonym?
it's pretty poor.
Wayne is his middle name in fairness.
Exactly.
So he has kind of run with that.
And so if you saw emails from Wayne Tracker and knew that it was somebody inside Exxon, it wouldn't take you a whole lot of time to work out who that might be. And again, it's one of those pseudonyms which has been thought up as a semi-joke. It's done for a serious purpose so that you can converse about something without having to declare that in a freedom of information request, for instance. So there's something slightly sinister about it. But you know, when people do these things, somebody of his caliber, Wayne Tillerson, and the job that he did, I'm always amazed at how casually they adopt some of these things, that they go in for something.
But this is the great trap of the online world, isn't
Absolutely.
It? That it promotes informality.
It does. And it promotes jokes, and jokes are always a giveaway. Whenever you sort of commit a little joke, or a little witticism, it says something about you. And that something can actually easily relate back to who you are.
Are you suggesting that senses of humor could be a biometric identification?
Absolutely. Which is why I have never had a pseudonym.
that's what you would say, of course.
Of course.
I mean, it does sound like it sounds like Rex Tillerson's answer to one of those what's your whatever name jokes. I'm not sure where. So if it's the first name is your middle name and the last name is the name of, I don't know, your first pet or something.
The name of the street you grew up on.
Yeah, have we come up with his porn star name or some other similar name? I mean, the thing is, though, Jacob, the more serious story underpinning this is that this is not the first story of this sort we have had about Trump's administration and its officials and the fact that he himself is apparently still merrily tweeting from an unsecured phone. How much more ridiculous in retrospect does the Hillary Clinton email flap look now, even compared to how ridiculous it looked at the time?
I mean, it looks ridiculous. There's no sort of understating that. But I mean, you know, it's also at some point there's so many things going on in the Trump administration. There are so many new stories, new questions emerging that it almost falls into the background, these echoes of sort of, well, remember what we were discussing in October 2016? Well, it's now March 2017, and we've gone through, you know, 45 major scandals, 150 minor scandals, 300,000 minor human interest stories.
Are these precise figures? Are you carving them on the wall?
How do you think I spend my day?
Orders of magnitude.
No, I mean, it's just, but this is actually, I mean, I'm joking slightly, but it's a serious issue because there's sort of a shotgun effect of there's so much information that it's difficult to focus on any one piece of it.
George Burns used to have a great line that Ronald Reagan used to use occasionally. He used to say, it's a great shame that the people who really know how to run this country are all driving cabs and cutting hair. And in a sense,
Or presenting current affairs radio programs.
And what you've got in the White House, you've got a New York cab driver as president. And one of his friends said, he is our first people's president. He's not got a military background, a political background. He is a people's president. Well, he's a New York cab driver. And that's the mentality. And what you get with that is what you would get if a New York cab driver became president. It is a great experiment in the greatest democracy of the world. We wait with bated breath to see how it'll go.
I am now recalling my many experiences of New York City cab drivers and shuddering inwardly. Michael Clark and Jacob Parakilis, thank you very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's episode. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Gaia Lutz and Helena Jarit. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next at 1900, it's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. The Daily has more on the day's main stories at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.